a party at her brother's home last year. Langdon had listened carefully and then replied, "Sounds more like magic than science." Catherine winked playfully.
"They're closer than you think, Robert."
Now Solomon's assistant returned to the phone.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Solomon is trying to get off a conference call. Things are a little chaotic here this morning."
"That's not a problem. I can easily call back."
"Actually, he asked me to fill you in on his reason for contacting you, if you don't mind."
"Of course not." The assistant inhaled deeply.
"As you probably know, Professor, every year here in Washington, the board of the Smithsonian hosts a private gala to thank our most generous supporters. Many of the country's cultural elite attend."
Langdon knew his own bank account had too few zeros to qualify him as culturally elite, but he wondered if maybe Solomon was going to invite him to attend nonetheless.
"This year, as is customary," the assistant continued, "the dinner will be preceded by a keynote address. We've been lucky enough to secure the National Statuary Hall for that speech."
The best room in all of D.C., Langdon thought, recalling a political lecture he had once attended in the dramatic semicircular hall. It was hard to forget 500 folding chairs splayed in a perfect arc, surrounded by 38 life-size statues, in a room that had once served as the nation's original House of Representatives chamber.
"The problem is this," the man said. "Our speaker has fallen ill and has just informed us she will be unable to give the address."
He paused awkwardly.
"This means we are desperate for a replacement speaker, and Mr. Solomon is hoping you would consider filling in."
Langdon did a double take. "Me?" This was not at all what he had expected. "I'm sure Peter could find a far better substitute."
"You're Mr. Solomon's first choice, Professor, and you're being much too modest. The institution's guests would be thrilled to hear from you, and Mr. Solomon thought you could give the same lecture you gave on Bookspan TV a few years back. That way you wouldn't have to prepare a thing. He said your talk involved symbolism in the architecture of our nation's capital. It sounds absolutely perfect for the venue."
Langdon was not so sure. "If I recall, that lecture had more to do with the Masonic history of the building than—"
"Exactly. As you know, Mr. Solomon is a Mason, as are many of his professional friends who will be in attendance. I'm sure they would love to hear you speak on the topic."
"I admit it would be easy." Langdon had kept the lecture notes from every talk he'd ever given. "I suppose I could consider it. What date is the event?" The assistant cleared his throat, sounding suddenly uncomfortable.
"Well, actually, sir, it's tonight."
Langdon laughed out loud. "Tonight?"
"That's why it's so hectic here this morning. The Smithsonian is in a deeply embarrassing predicament."
The assistant spoke more hurriedly now.
"Mr. Solomon is ready to send a private jet to Boston for you. The flight is only an hour, and you would be back home before midnight. You're familiar with the private air terminal at Boston's Logan Airport?"
"I am," Langdon admitted reluctantly. "No wonder Peter always gets his way."
"Wonderful. Would you be willing to meet the jet there at, say, 5 o'clock?
"You haven't left me much choice, have you?" Langdon chuckled.
"I just want to make Mr. Solomon happy, sir."
Peter has that effect on people. Langdon considered it a long moment, seeing no way out. "All right, tell him I can do it."
"Outstanding," the assistant exclaimed,
sounding deeply relieved. He gave Langdon the jet's tail number and various other information. When Langdon finally hung up, he wondered if Peter Solomon had ever been told no. Returning to his coffee preparation, Langdon scooped some additional beans into the grinder. "A little extra caffeine this morning," he thought. "It's going to be a long day." Chapter 4. The U.S. Capitol building stands regally at the eastern end of the National Mall, on a raised plateau that city designer Pierre L'Enfant described as a pedestal waiting for a monument. The Capitol's massive footprint measures more than 750 feet in length and 350 feet deep. Housing more than 16 acres of floor space, it contains an astonishing 541 rooms. The neoclassical architecture is meticulously designed to echo the grandeur of ancient Rome, whose ideals were the inspiration for America's founders in establishing the laws and culture of the new republic. The new security checkpoint for tourists entering the Capitol building is located deep within the recently completed subterranean visitor center, beneath a magnificent glass skylight that frames the Capitol dome. Newly hired security guard Alfonso Nunez carefully studied the male visitor now approaching his checkpoint. The man had a shaved head and had been lingering in the lobby, completing a phone call before entering the building. His right arm was in a sling, and he moved with a slight limp. He was wearing a tattered Army-Navy surplus coat, which, combined with his shaved head, made Nunez guess military. Those who had served in the U.S. Armed Forces were among the most common visitors to Washington. "Good evening, sir," Nunez said, following the security protocol of verbally engaging any male visitor who entered alone.
"Hello?"
the visitor said, glancing around at the nearly deserted entry.
"Quiet night."
"NFC playoffs," Nunez replied. "Everyone's watching the Redskins tonight." Nunez wished he were, too, but this was his first month on the job, and he'd drawn the short straw.
"Metal objects in the dish, please."
As the visitor fumbled to empty the pockets of his long coat with his one working hand, Nunez watched him carefully. Human instinct made special allowances for the injured and handicapped, but it was an instinct Nunez had been trained to override. Nunez waited while the visitor removed from his pockets the usual assortment of loose change, keys, and a couple of cell phones.
"Sprain?"
Nunez asked, eyeing the man's injured hand, which appeared to be wrapped in a series of thick ace bandages. The bald man nodded.
"Slipped on the ice a week ago. Still hurts like hell."
"Sorry to hear that. Walk through, please." The visitor limped through the detector, and the machine buzzed in protest. The visitor frowned.
"I was afraid of that. I'm wearing a ring under these bandages. My finger was too swollen to get it off, so the doctors wrapped right over it."
"No problem," Nunez said. "I'll use the wand." Nunez ran the metal detection wand over the visitor's wrapped hand. As expected, the only metal he detected was a large lump on the man's injured ring finger. Nunez took his time rubbing the metal detector over every inch of the man's sling and finger. He knew his supervisor was probably monitoring him on the closed circuit in the building's security center, and Nunez needed this job. Always better to be cautious. He carefully slid the wand up inside the man's sling. The visitor winced in pain.
"Sorry." "It's okay," the man said. "You can't be too careful these days."
"Ain't that the truth?" Nunez liked this guy. Strangely, that counted for a lot around here. Human instinct was America's first line of defense against terrorism. It was a proven fact that human intuition was a more accurate detector of danger than all the electronic gear in the world. The gift of fear, as one of their security reference books termed it. In this case, Nunez's instincts sensed nothing that caused him any fear. The only oddity that he noticed, now that they were